Thank you, Kat. And this is, of course, The Naked Scientist, Dr. Chris, Dr. Dave and Dr. Kat. Time now to join none other than Peter Metcalf, who is from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. He has uncovered a very interesting crystal structure of an insect virus. It makes these things in cells, and they behave a bit like a viral sarcophagus. The virus gets locked away inside this crystal structure, and it protects the virus when it gets out of the insect into the soil, because these things wait for hapless insects to come by and then infect them. Here's the guy who's discovered it. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. You've published this in the journal Nature recently, so it's obviously an important discovery. It's been a mystery for some time, though, hasn't it, how these things worked?
Yes. These crystals have been known since the end of the 19th century, and in fact they were the first viruses, the only viruses that you can actually see with a microscope. And people have always been puzzled about what these crystals are, and it turns out that the crystals actually contain virus particles. Virus particles, of course, are much too small to see with a microscope.
How many are in each crystal, Peter?
Each crystal contains thousands of virus particles. So the actual infectious object that the insect eats when it gets infected is a little crystal containing virus particles.
Why does it need to resort to that? Because there are lots of viruses around that don't use this technique. So why do these insect viruses have to make these clever sort of sarcophagi to lock themselves away into?
Well, I guess nobody really knows that, but what we think is that the crystals stabilize the virus. So most viruses don't last very long in the environment, but these crystals containing the viruses last for years and years. In fact, when you eat a cabbage from the supermarket, you're likely to be eating these viruses because the crystals last so long. They're really impossible to get rid of.
Now, how did you break the structure of them? How did you work out what they were made of, these crystals, and solve this mystery?
Yes, well, while the crystals are big enough to see in a light microscope, they're very small compared with the crystals that protein crystallographers generally use. So we're X-ray crystallographers, and we use a very special new micro X-ray beam at the Swiss light source, which is a synchrotron near Zurich. And we use this beam to shoot these crystals to figure out the atomic structure.
So in other words, the X-ray goes into the crystal, it gets bounced about all over the place, and the pattern of beams of light that come out tell you something about how the atoms must be arranged inside the crystal.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So now you've sussed this out. Does it tell us anything useful in terms of how we might be able to exploit these particular crystals for, say, medicine or technology?
Yes, it certainly does, because, of course, what we did was to figure out the atomic structure of the crystals, so we know kind of how they're made in great detail. And that means that we can modify them. And the interesting thing is we found inside the crystal nucleotides, the subunits of DNA, and that means that we can put, for example, other things in these crystals. And we also know how to put things into crystals instead of the virus, in place of the virus. So the crystals can be used as kind of micro containers, very small little objects for containing other things and stabilizing them.
So given that you can stabilize a virus naturally, that's how the insect virus works, and a big problem in, say, the third world with vaccines is keeping things in a fridge because third world countries don't have power for long enough to power fridges. Could you therefore use this as a novel kind of vaccine technology where you could put very fragile viruses inside these things? They would be stabilized, they could then be transported all over the place and given to people when they needed them, and they would protect them.
Yes, that's certainly one of our thoughts. There's a whole variety of applications. The lack of stability of proteins in general is a big problem in biotechnology, and so a nice method like this for stabilizing them is generally important.
Peter, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Professor Peter Metcalf, who is at the University of Auckland and has discovered the structure of these interesting insect virus crystals that are behaving a bit like a sarcophagus for virus particles.
Fancy listening to The Naked Scientists in your bed, on your way to work, or even at work? Mm-hmm. Why not subscribe to our podcast? For more information, visit nakedscientists.com/podcast.
The Naked Scientists with Dr. Chris, Dr. Dave and Dr. Kat, and it's been our science festival best of the fest. Wonderful things going on at Cambridge University. It's cambridgescience.org, their website, if you want to find out what you can go and see this week. It's all free, and we'll also be covering it with a special series of Naked Scientists dedicated podcasts, which involve us going out and seeing what events there are and then turning them into little programmes, which you can get from our website, which is nakedscientists.com. And it's a big week for our website because Dr. Dave has achieved the unachievable. Well, you know, we've totally overhauled it. Dave, When we started doing this project, how long did we reckon it was going to take us to just, you know, we thought we would just turn the old side into this brand spanking new one?
Yeah, it was 3 or 4 months at the most, wasn't it?
Did we say as long as that? I thought
maybe
that we were going to get someone to help us with a few designs and then we would just take a couple of weeks to translate the content over and it would be easy. How long's it taken you now?
It's about 8 months, isn't it?
Yeah. But
how many hours a day have you been working? Come on, be honest.
Probably at least 9 or 10 most days.
He's going for a pay rise.
I tell you, it's really paid off, though. We've already had comments from Reg in Australia and David, who said that they really, really like the new website. And it's fantastic. Right now, if you go to the main Naked Scientist page, you can see us on the webcam. When the show's live, you can see us on the webcam and you can see the bit where Chris nipped out to the toilet.
I was going to say, Dave pointed out to me, he said, hey, by the way, Chris, you know the new site shows the webcam from the studio, it shows where we all are and when we're in here, and you can see you're notable by your absence. So there you are, talking on this programme, you're not actually here.
And also, we had a question in from Ted Tryon, who wanted to know where the podcast from the end of February and the beginning of March had gone.
Yeah,
but
Dave.
They should all be back up there now, I understand.
Yeah, and much easier to find now. Much
exactly.
Better navigable.
So go and check it out, thenakedscientist.com.
But Dave, just so people are aware, we're not just gratuitously sort of banging on about this. What are the key sort of features that you think make this site much easier for people to use now?
Well, it's much easier to use. Navigation's a lot better. We've now collected all the things like kitchen science. All the kitchen science are in one place. So if you want to do an experiment, which you heard months ago, you can do it.
Because there's pages and pages of all the experiments with what you need, how you do it, this is what you're looking for, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it should be. It's very easy for us to change, so you should be able to keep it really up to date and you should be able to see everything really well.
It's an absolute bargain. Anyway, it's getting close to the end of the show now, so we've had some answers in on our teaser, so we're going to reveal the answer to you. Our teaser today was, if the entire Sahara Desert was covered in solar panels, how much electricity would it generate? And now Dave has been hard at work with the figures trying to figure this one out.
Well, first of all, before he gives us the answer, can you just tell us, you know, who said what? What kind of answers did we get?
OK, here we had some answers. So, for example, Connor in Tillingham said 600 million kilowatts. And my sums, although they're not terribly great, that works out as 6 times 10 to the 11. We've had Daniel in Clacton who says 1 billion, that's 1 times 10 to the 12. And we've also had Mike in Beatley who says 100,000 million watts, so that's 1 times 10 to the 11. So what is the answer?
Well, the Sahara apparently is about 9 million square kilometres. That's about 9 trillion square metres. Near the equator, you get about a kilowatt of solar energy per square metre. So that's about 9,000 trillion watts.
Hitting the entire
Sahara Desert
in terms of solar energy?
Yeah. Right. Now, solar cells at the best, maybe about a third, 30% efficient, so that's taking it down to about 3,000 trillion watts. And because you get night time and day and night time, it's probably about another third, another quarter. It's about 1,000 trillion watts, or 1 times 10 to the 15 watts.
So that's a petawatt, is it?
Yeah. Compared to that, the UK uses about 70 gigawatts of power, maximum generation
capacity. So we could power the world pretty much.
Pretty much,
the Sahara
yeah.
Desert then. I mean, 1 petawatt, I know that figure because that's the power of the Gulf Stream, the hot current that brings warm water from the tropics up towards Europe, north in the Atlantic, and keeps us warm and means the grass grows for a long time in Cornwall.
Yep, so when solar panels are cheap, it should work beautifully.
So why haven't we turned the Sahara into a sort of array of solar cells then?
Just solar cells are so expensive, it just wouldn't be economic at all.
I think it's nicer as a desert, to be honest. Anyway, what we want to know is the winner, and the winner tonight is Carolyn in Chelmsford, who said 750 terawatts, and that's 7.5 times 10 to the 14, if my sums are correct. Also, very close was Megan in London, but it's Carolyn in Chelmsford who wins the mud-powered clock from Noisemakers.
Thank you very much to the Noisemakers, I guess. I want one of those. Thanks. You can get them from the Science Museum as well.
I want to impress my friends.
I've got a quick question here from Chris, who's in Great Yarmouth, and says, Chris and Co, great show. Please don't ever stop. Can I just ask you, when you're travelling anywhere, why does it always seem that when you go home, you get to the destination more quickly? What do you think?
I reckon it's because you know your way when you're going home. And it's also twice as fast if you've had anything to drink and you're trying to walk or cycle home. You kind of get hyperspeed.
Well, you're one of those people that say, I'm too drunk to walk, so I had to drive. Is that what
I would never do that.
So you reckon on the way out you're paying much more attention, so
exactly.
You see more things, so it feels like it's longer.
And maybe if you're a bit unsure about where you're going, you might take longer to get there.
Yeah, I think it's down to how much conscious perception we place, because when you know a route very well, you can if you say to someone, can you recollect doing all these manoeuvres and going around these roundabouts and things? And people will say no. You know, I drive along and I don't think I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing, but I can't recall moment by moment having made some of the manoeuvres I did on the journey. And I think it becomes sort of subconscious, and because it's becoming more automatic and subconscious, you're paying less attention, and as a result, you're not seeing the same things that you would see normally to your conscious brain, and therefore it doesn't seem to take so long.
So if you're going home, then you're probably not paying so much attention.
Right, very quick one for you, Dave, in 30 seconds. Tristan Knowles is in Melbourne, Australia, and says, hi, Dr. Chris, what causes the Earth to have a magnetic field?
They're not entirely sure, but they think it's to do with the centre of the Earth is a big liquid metal ball, and you get convection currents in that, and there's a strange thing where that excites itself and turns itself into dynamo. You get electric currents, which make it an electromagnet, and that's what they reckon is causing the Earth's magnetic field.
Because it does flip from time to time. I think isn't the average is about once every 100,000 years, but in fact it's less than that.
Yeah, they reckon we're due for one fairly soon, and the Earth's magnetic field getting weaker quite fast
so
at the moment.
So the North Pole becomes the South Pole.
Yep.
Well, thank you, guys. Thank you very much, Dave and Kat, for a wonderful show. On next week's Naked Scientist, we'll be taking to the air, quite literally, because we'll be looking at the world of flight, and that goes for both man and beast, because Jenny Goodman will be here from Oxford University to explain how aeroplanes can now be made to fly at Mach 6. That's 6 times the speed of sound, or 2 kilometres a second. Find out how that works next week. Plus, Graham Taylor, who's also from Oxford, will be airing his views about the latest research on how animals fly, and he'll also be answering the age-old question about how does a fly land on the ceiling. Quick last question here. If an aeroplane was on a runway comprising a giant conveyor belt moving at the same speed as the aeroplane but in the opposite direction, would the plane get airborne? Can you help us with that? Chris@nakedscientist.com. Thanks to our wonderful production team here at the BBC. See you next week.